You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Hi, Alan.
Hey, Castor. Hey, Sophia.
Hello.
How are we?
Good, good. Looking forward to Dear Science this week. What have we got on the agenda?
Well, we're going to kick off with batteries.
Batteries.
Which might sound not particularly exciting, but let's say that you needed a pacemaker or something like that. Mm. And you can get your pacemaker. That's great. But every 5 years or so, they've got to replace your battery. Okay, right. So that doesn't involve, going the whole hog and everything. As I understand it, the battery's just implanted under the skin, and so it's just a quick little incision and replace the battery and everything like that. But it would be nice if you had to have a pacemaker or things called neurostimulators, which act, as it says on the bottle, they stimulate your nerves to, carry out particular things like promoting blood flow to the brain after you've had a stroke, something like that.
Right.
All of these implanted devices need some sort of power source. And up until now, the power source has been essentially some sort of battery, which, is sensible. In the early days of pacemakers, in fact, which surprised me, way back in, probably about the 60s, I guess, when they were first mm-hmm. becoming common, they got around this problem by using plutonium, that you had plutonium-powered pacemakers.
Yeah, that doesn't...
And, what seemed to happen was that, for the most part, that the device would outlive the patient, usually.
That's not so bad.
But it certainly never meant that you needed to go in and replace the battery and stuff like that. But, so there's obviously a problem here. Oh, and that's right, yes, and you weren't allowed to be cremated or something if you had a plutonium pacemaker.
Naturally.
So when you died, they had to, take it out of you and send it back to Oak Ridge, Tennessee, or wherever it came from. But anyway, sort of getting off the topic here. So if you need some sort of battery-powered implant, then it would be nice if you didn't need to replace the battery. And so people obviously realize this is a very good idea. And so there's a bunch of Chinese workers at Tianjin University in China, and they have just now come up with a soft, flexible battery. And what it uses as its power source is oxygen in the blood.
Sweet.
And so that means that you need never go on and replace your battery, essentially. So technically what this is going to do is just going to run forever as long as you've still got oxygen in your blood. And it's a brilliant idea. It's a brilliant idea because, whenever oxygen reacts with anything, it essentially gives up electrons, and so electrons are, it's electric current, and so you can use those to power whatever it is that you want to power. So obviously there's going to be some sort of technical problems with this, some things that you've got to get around, and first of all is, what the heck do you make your battery out of? That is going to be compatible with your body, basically. So you'd obviously plutonium is out of the question.
Cutting that out, yeah. Eliminating that from the start.
And so what they came up with is a mixture of sodium and gallium and tin and gold. So these are four elements which are fairly sort of benign in terms of your body. There's nothing particularly nasty there. There's nothing that's going to kill you, nothing that's sort of long-term going to be detrimental to your health. And so they've got a sodium gallium tin alloy, and then the other electrode in your electrochemical setup is a gold, nanoporous gold. Okay, so nanoporous, so it's got tiny little holes in it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then what they do is they put these electrodes in a porous polymer. So in other words, so fluids can flow through it, which is what you're after, obviously, because you've got your oxygen in your blood. That's where your power source is going to come from the oxygen. And so your porous polymer sort of serves two purposes. First of all, it makes sure that your electrodes stay in contact with the blood, essentially, so that they can get the oxygen out of that. And second of all, it protects them as well. So, they're not just sort of sitting there open to everything in your body, which could be detrimental to them. So they're sitting there in this porous polymer, and essentially you've just got sort of the blood flowing through, and they suck up the oxygen and away they go. And technically this should work nicely. Now, so what have they done? They have done it on rats at the moment. As with all sort of, you know, medical advances, they do animal trials first just to make sure that everything is going as it should. So they implanted these things in the backs of rats, and they were managing to get a voltage about 1.3 volts out of these things, and they were managing to keep them running for around about 4 weeks or so, okay, which doesn't sound a heck of a long time. And also, with the 1.3 volts, there's not enough power there to be able to power any sort of thing like a pacemaker or something that, that they're eventually going to be looking towards doing. However, this is sort of proof of concept. And, you know, this is a big, I guess, stepping stone to something that will ultimately come about, you know.
Cyborg augments.
Yeah. You know, there's lots of stuff that they still have to figure out. Lots and lots and lots. But, you know, they've made this first step, and it's just so cool. And I guess when you think about it, it's pretty darn obvious that you've got these energy sources in the body that you can tap to power these devices that may be keeping you alive. So, you know, anything that minimizes invasive anythings in the body is got to be a good thing. So, you know, once they put these things in, eventually it's going to get to the point where, you know, they're there till you die, basically, and they're just going to keep running and running and running because they're going to be powered on essentially a limitless resource present in your blood. So, you know, brilliant, brilliant thinking. Why didn't I think of that? And, you know, which is what I say about every week on Dear Science, I think, because, you know, sometimes the best ideas are the most sort of obvious, really, and everything's obvious in hindsight when it comes to science. So, yeah.
All right, moving on to the solar eclipse. I said this morning when I was introducing it, I can't quite remember exactly what time it was.
I was watching it. It was around about half seven, I think, something like that, there or thereabouts. Right, I was watching it live on TV, and oh my goodness me, you know, I've never seen one. I'd desperately love to see one.
I think I recall one. Oh, it would have been in like what, 2012 or something like that. Mm-hmm. We might have had one in New Zealand. Yeah. I can't quite remember.
I was out of the country in 2012, so that probably explains a lot, actually. But you know, they're amazing things, and you can only imagine the awe, and you know, used in its real sense, the awe that early humans must have felt when, you know, it's a nice sunny day like today, and then all of a sudden, boom, the sun disappears. What the hell's going on? And it's quite remarkable that they did figure out essentially how to predict these things roughly. Anyway, so we're talking, you know, people a few thousand years ago, that long ago, like the Babylonians, Greeks, Romans, etc., etc. So they figured out that there was some sort of cycle to these things, both the lunar eclipses and the solar eclipses. And but in terms of absolutely figuring out to almost, you know, the day or the hour or whatever, that had to wait till around about the 1700s or so. And the guy called Halley, from Halley's Comet fame, apparently, he was the first person to sort of predict that, yep, London is going to get this eclipse this particular time, this particular day, et cetera, et cetera,
right.
et cetera. And of course, you know, eclipses, it's all about the moon passing in front or between the Earth and the Sun. And so, you know, why is it a big deal, I guess, is the question that I'm asking today. What can we possibly learn from monitoring an eclipse? And so if you were watching it this morning, you would see that essentially as the moon's disk moves completely over the sun, you see this bright area around
The
sun.
Around the edges.
And this is what you don't normally see with the sun by itself. So when you know, put your hand in front of the sun, or you put a round disk in front of the sun, you don't manage to see things as clearly as you do with a real solar eclipse. And so this is the thing called the corona, the sun's corona. And the weird thing about the sun's corona is its temperature. Like, it's about millions of degrees Celsius in the corona, whereas on the surface of the sun, it's around about 6,000 degrees. So, the sun, the surface of the sun's really, really cold, but then you've got this really, really hot part just outside the sun, and we still don't know why that is.
I mean, we should clarify, that's not really, really, that's still, like, very, very hot.
Oh, that is really, oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, yes, 1,000 degrees, it's, that's going to melt most things, yes. But in terms of, but this corona, so this is one of the rare times that you get to study the corona without having to worry about what's going on with the rest of the sun and everything and having to block out stuff and everything. So you get this perfect view of the corona. So that's of interest to scientists, looking at, you know, what's going on with the corona. Also the ionosphere, okay, which is part of the Earth's atmosphere, and that's involved in transmitting radio waves and so communications, et cetera, et cetera. And so what they can then look at, obviously in the middle of a solar eclipse, they can look at the effect of this rapid darkening on what's going on in the ionosphere and how that affects communications, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And this very rapid darkening, as opposed to normally, you know, just the sun sort of slowly going down, it's this rapid darkening that, you know, could have effects that they don't know about. And so they're going to study this as well. The other thing, the zoologists are getting into it and studying animals and birds and stuff like that. So, you know, how do they behave when all of a sudden it turns dark in the middle of the day? So you know, that's a huge sort of area of research. And so, you know, what they find is that generally that birds stop flying all of a sudden because it's dark and they don't fly at night generally. The roosters start crowing and the cicadas start chirping, you know, and then it gets bright again and it all goes to heck. So, you know, very sort of just these weird effects. And you know, there's all sorts of science that can be done just on the basis of monitoring solar eclipses. So fascinating stuff. And, you know, as I said, I'd really love to see one day.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. And then lastly, we've got here a star explosion.
Yes, indeed. Okay, we're keeping sort of in the sky, I guess, for the last story. And so now, speaking of predicting things, so we can predict solar eclipses down to the second now, essentially. But it's very, very rare that you can predict with great certainty other sort of things going on in the heavens. But what we do know is that sometime between now and September, so they can predict it to that amount of precision, what we should be able to see is a massive explosion called a nova.
Right.
And so this is a result of two stars. And one of them is a thing called a red giant, which means it's coming close to the end of its life. It's used up all of its hydrogen and it expands hugely. That's what's going to happen to our sun in about 5 billion years' time.
Right.
It gets enormous, enormous, enormous. And then there's a white dwarf. And that's basically what happens to the red giant after it undergoes undergoes a big bang and it ends up as a white dwarf. And this white dwarf is rotating around this, or revolving around this red giant. Mm-hmm. And every 80 or so years, what happens is apparently, so the red giant's busy ejecting matter, it ends up on this white dwarf, and after about 80 odd years, it's accumulated enough matter that it has to undergo this big explosion to get rid of it. And this big explosion can be seen with the naked eye. And so they're saying that sometime between now and September, we should be able to see this. So, you know, what happens is in a few seconds, basically, the temperature goes up by 100 or 200 million degrees. This is, we're talking a big, big, big explosion here. And what will be seen is essentially something very, 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 very hard to see with the naked eye will all of a sudden be about as, about as bright as Mars. So if you know Mars in the night sky, you see that lovely red planet there. And so it's going to get as bright as that pretty much instantaneously. So we don't know exactly when it's going to happen. Between now and September, sometime around there. Trouble is, you can only see it in the northern hemisphere for autumn and winter for us. But if it sort of delays until September or so, then sort of spring, summer, we can see it in the southern hemisphere. So,
right.
So fingers crossed it sort of, you know, waits for a while.
Yeah, stall it out a little bit we get to see.
Yeah, get to see something cool, yeah.
Is it a sort of like blink and you'll miss it, or will it
it'll keep going for a while. Yeah.
So like a week, a month, do we know?
That's a really good question, but my guess would be probably, you know, a month or so, or, you know, possibly at least, and then it just sort of dims again, and then the whole process repeats. Another 80 years' time, it'll happen again.
Right. So, yeah. Any listeners who have plans 80 years from now should definitely put that one in the calendar.
Absolutely, yes.
All right. Thank you for coming on the show today, Alan.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Moshat. Yes. And thank you, Science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the bee.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Moshat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.